for having me, basically. And it's been a long time since I've been here. I think last time I was here, Perimeter was still at the old building in King Street. And I walked by, and it still says PI on the door. But it's a very deserted place now. But this is an even more bustling and, you know, fantastic place. And really happy I came here. This is about a work I did with jointly with Bob Wald and Akihiro Ishibashi about a half a year or so, a bit longer ago. And it's about these three topics where black holes are the least important, but of course we have in mind space-time with black holes. Now, let me just give a little bit of history, because I think this may be a bit more diverse audience than just pure gravity people. So the history of gravitational radiation is a long one, but basically in the 60s, Bondi and his collaborators put it all together and worked out the theory of gravitational waves from, probably now say a physics viewpoint, but their conclusions were all correct. And the key paper in the series is this one. So it's number 7, so there were a few before and one or two after, but it's really this one, and that's how it's called. And it's with Bondi, van der Borg, and Metzner, this joint paper. So the paper was, as the title says, restricted to axisymmetric solutions, but that restriction was just made for calculational simplicity, and it was in no way essential. And in fact, Sachs, just 1 year later, then did the analysis in complete generality. But the key achievement of that paper were the derivation of what is now called Bondi coordinates, and I'll go about telling you what these are. And his basic idea was to take the metric and do kind of a one on R expansion, and see what sort of the asymptotic tail was, and to see what Einstein's equations tell you about it. But to do that properly, you'd have to define first what you mean by R, in other words, Bondi coordinates. And then they importantly identified what one would probably call a residual symmetry. So after you've done all the gauge fixing you can, there's still what's the freedom that's left that you can't eliminate, is in some sense the group of symmetries. I'll explain. The talk is all about this, so I'll explain it. And they clearly understood the geometric significance of this group. And he understood how to characterize their information that's carried by gravitational waves, and they even called it news. And it's a good choice of words to call this information. And he gave a proof that if you didn't have any news, then the space-time had to be stationary and vice versa. Actually, he only proved one direction, but the complete proof, the sort of difficult direction, which probably was he thought was evident, but it's not evident, was done by Garrosch in this famous 77 paper. And so I'll come back to that in higher dimensions. So conformal infinity wasn't introduced then, so now probably most people who have had a course in GR are familiar at some level with this concept of scry, as it's called, or asymptotic infinity, or even you don't work with it on a regular basis. But most people know what this concept is, and that was introduced a year later by Roger Penrose, and his key idea was to introduce conformal techniques into the subjects. And it's just, in some sense, it's just a different language, but it makes much more transparent the geometric picture of what's going on. And since most of us, we don't think in equations, but we think in pictures, because our eyes are so important, we think in pictures. So these geometric pictures make it much easier for us to see theorems and proofs and facts. So it was a very important idea to set it up this way. And as maybe you know, the way it works is that you have your line element, and that's for all of space-time, but then you decide you're going to multiply it by a so-called conformal factor. And this conformal factor I'm going to call omega here. And it's done in such a way that what is infinity becomes a place in this, relative to this so-called unphysical metric. So there's no physics in this metric. It's just to put infinity at a definite place. So So it might makes it easier for you to think about it. And then this new space-time has a, the infinity is now this finite place, which you, technically you attach to your space-time. And because I guess I is a script letter is, was used, so Penrose said it, he called this scry. I think it's, this terminology is due to Penrose. And so more precisely, you say that the rescaled metric should be smooth at this boundary, and it should be zero. This omega should be zero there, because clearly, if some you have some infinite distance relative to ds, if that's supposed to become a finite distance relative to the new metric, this conformal factor has to shrink distances, so it has to go to zero. And so its gradient should not go to zero, so you can use it as a coordinate then. So here is a picture. I took some drawing lessons from Roger Penrose to do this. But here is what you know as the stereographic projection, where the space is a R2, Euclidean R2 with this plus line element here. And you all know the stereographic projection by which infinity becomes the north pole of this sphere. And if you work out what the conformal factor is according to my equation, relative to the usual round sphere metric, is the sine squared of theta over 2. And so you can do the same with the Lorentzian signature, but then the picture is somewhat different. And it is different in the sense that infinity is not just a point, but it's actually a more complicated structure. It consists of various points. It consists of spatial infinity. That's really just a point here, this one. But then it consists of these extended surfaces. This is all just in 1+1 dimensions, which are not points, but null surfaces, or null lines in this picture relative to this conformally rescaled metric. Now, actually, in saying that you can attach this conformal infinity, you're imposing a condition, because you're saying that your space-time is sufficiently similar to Minkowski space, so that at infinity, it again looks like that. And so let me just, because there are people do play so much around so much with asymptotic conditions, let me put down what are, I think, some general guiding principles for writing down asymptotic conditions. So first one is your asymptotic condition. So it means like you consider metrics which fall off at some rate, that let's say that's your condition. But the condition shouldn't be so strong that you by hand rule out interesting solutions that correspond to interesting dynamical processes inside the space-time. So let's suppose, for instance, you were to impose that your metric is exactly Minkowskian outside a compact set, then by the positive mass theorem, the only solution is Minkowski space. So you've ruled out too much. But if you rule out too little, and then you're in the opposite, you have the opposite problem. So on the other hand, the asymptotic conditions should be sufficiently strong so as to be able to define global quantities associated with this space-time. So these are competing principles. So you've got to find the right balance between. And so reasonable people can disagree as to what are reasonable conditions, but the reasonable people should obey these two general principles. So the story is actually completely straightforward at spatial infinity. So if I go in a spatial direction, and you can in fact say even that the metric outside this room or outside a compact set is equal exactly to Kerr, not just asymptotically, but even exactly. And so that is so there is not an essential restriction. So this is not a trivial fact at all. Mathematicians have shown it. And so you can do this, but it's highly non-trivial at null infinity, because you see you want to impose Einstein's equations, of course, on your metric. Like I'm going to just look at the vacuum equation for simplicity. And then because it's this, you should think of this as an initial value problem. So your field propagates, and you're not free to just say how it's going to decay. It's just going to do what it wants and not what you tell it to do. And so you when you say you impose an asymptotic condition, you're basically pretending you know how a solution decays. And of course, we don't really know this. So if you ask for exactly what type of initial data on a Cauchy surface are these asymptotic condition satisfied? And this is a highly non-trivial question. So my asymptotic condition is just that I can find this conformal factor such that my scry looks like in Minkowski space. That's my asymptotic condition. And then the scry is smooth. But if you ask what I'm saying is if you ask exactly what initial data will give this to me, then nobody really knows. But for it, it's certainly some things are known. So for instance, these conditions are linearly stable. So if I take a solution like Kerr or anything that satisfies my asymptotic conditions, then the linear perturbation, if it has initially compact support, then this linear perturbation will still satisfy. You can show this. Actually, Garage and Santopoulos did show that in 1977 and do similar thing in more than 40 dimensions. And Chris Sedullo and Kleinemann, mathematicians, and these people show that if you input even a small nonlinear perturbation, then even this small nonlinear perturbation is decayed so fast that it doesn't destroy this nice scribe. So these are very complicated mathematical theorems. And you can actually, Frederick had another way to convince yourself that these conditions that I'm going to impose are reasonable. So now this talk, I'm just going to impose my conditions, which are going to be as follows. So my condition is that I can find this conformal factor such that the conformally rescaled metric is smooth at infinity. So that's just my condition. So since it's easier and more suggestive to work with coordinates called R and U and so on for people with an education in relativity, I'm going to do that too. So now I'm just going to define a function R, which is 1 over omega. And I'm going to choose so you see there is a lot of freedom in choosing this conformal factor. So you can choose, if you multiply it by any smooth function which doesn't vanish at infinity, that's another good conformal factor. So I'm going to use I'm going to make a particularly nice choice, and that you make a choice. You have to show that this is possible, but it is such that the metric, if you take R to be 1 on omega, the metric is going to take this form here. So U is another coordinate. I'm going to illustrate. I'm going to show you what these coordinates mean in a second. So what R is 1 on omega. Then there is the coordinate u, which is kind of advanced time. And then there are some angular coordinates, like which direction in the sky I'm going to point. That's z. So that z is just polar angles, like theta and phi. And so then there are various tensor fields. There's a field alpha, a field beta a, and a field gamma ab. So a and b, or ab are angles, as I said, theta and phi. And so you can then take in this coordinate system, which is now geometrically defined, you make these expansions. So you say you'd expand it 1 on R. That's sort of what Bonnie said, what Bonnie did. You expand it 1 on R, and then you get just an expansion like this. Nobody cares whether this is convergent or not. It's just an asymptotic expansion. And so for instance, in Schwarzschild, the alpha is 1 on 2 plus m over R, where m is the mass of the black hole. Beta is 0, and gamma AB is just a round unit sphere metric. So that would be exactly Schwarzschild. But for Kerr, this beta A would be non-zero. But you can still write it down explicitly. So now what's the nature of these coordinates? So I'm going to draw a scry as this null surface here. And the angles are like parameterizing these directions in the sky. R is a coordinate that's sort of perpendicular, to the extent that you can talk about perpendicular in Lorentzian geometry, to the surface. And U is the coordinate that goes up here. So omega equal to 0, what was omega equal to 0 is now become R equal to infinity, because R is 1 on omega. So you think of this constant U surfaces as follows. So someone flashes a light, and then you follow out the photons. And where they intersect, scry, that's a surface of constant U. So surface of constant U are kind of these photons crossing scry from a flash of light. So I'm going to call these Bondi coordinates. So there, again, U goes up there, R goes in there, and ZA is my angles. So they're not, the way I define it, they're technically a little different from Bondi's coordinates, but I've still got to call them Bondi coordinates. Now, what is clear, there is still some freedom left. So what is the freedom left? You can change the surface where u is 0. So you can, rather than saying this is u equal to 0, you can say this is u equal to 0. So you have can change the surface. You can apply a conformal transformation to the angles, because this is all just conformal, up to conformal transformation. And you can change, it turns out these r's are affinely parametrized, not geodesics, these things here. But you have a, on an affinely parametrized geodesic, you can multiply the affine parameter by a constant, and you can translate it by a constant. So you can have these, you can make these changes point per generator. So you have still have this freedom. And so you can, so the first transformation changing u per generator is the one which is of main interest in this talk. And if you want to think it's in equations, it's just you say you'd redefine u to be u plus a some function. You translate u by some angle dependent parameter. Yeah? So that's like and that's, it's called, it's, if you want it like infinitesimal language, that's the vector field it generates. So these vector fields or transformations are the so-called super translations, BMS super translations. So an ordinary time translation in Minkowski space corresponds to just a constant t here. And an ordinary spatial translation corresponds to the case when t is an L equal to 1 spherical harmonic. And all others don't come from the point group. So here is the geometric significance. So if I change this surface, so I translate this surface by an angle dependent amount, that means I go from this surface to this wiggly surface there. And it means that, why can't I just say I'm just going to do take this preferred surface? Why do I have to think of this as a symmetry? Why can't I just fix it? So the reason is that if you think operationally, and that's what sort of Bondi understood basically. He said that, okay, this thing is going to be, you can define this by flashing a light. But who is going to tell you if you're in a curved space where you have this light bulb? You can have it here or there. And maybe here there's a galaxy and there's some gravitational lensing or not. So you're going to, but there is no convention for picking out this the world line of this light bulb. So you have to stick with the ambiguity that you're not going to fix uniquely the surface. It's just like that. It's physically clear you cannot do it. In Minkowski space, you can, but in a curved space, you cannot.
So wait, this symmetry corresponds to choosing different world lines to
Yeah, so you're just going to declare your u equal to 0 surface not to be this one, but to be that one. And once you declare what your u equal to 0 surface is, it turns out you have then defined all other coordinates. How do you get to this point in the interior? You go back, and then you go inside with an affine geodesic. Yeah? So it turns out once you've defined the surface, you've defined everything. But you have the freedom to redefine the surface, and there is no preferred one, as I try to convince you physically that there is. Okay, so now this was just kinematics. I think you now understand what are super translations, I think. But now I want to actually do something dynamical. So I want to study the following situation. I have a space-time, and I'm now going to use a two-dimensional diagram. And I imagine I have a gravitational field which corresponds to a burst of radiation. So you got a stationary epoch here. You got some burst of gravitational radiation here. And just to make things easy, I pretend that afterwards you again have a stationary space-time. So in reality, it's just going to asymptote to this, but it doesn't matter. It's just much easier to think about it. And so here, outside here then, it's exact Kerr or exact Myers-Perry solution in higher dimensions. And up here, again, it's a stationary space-time. So I want to investigate the different, I know what is the metric here, and I know that it's a stationary metric here. I want to investigate the relationship between these two metrics. And so the U1 is my time before the radiation, gravitational radiation came. U1 is the time after. And I want to relate the metrics before U0 to the metric after U1. Okay. Clear question. So now you're going to have to show, look at Einstein's equations, obviously. So first I have to ask, what do we actually know about stationary metrics? So what is a stationary metric? Is, well, we run Einstein equations one way or another. But now stationary means that near infinity, because all we care about is near infinity for the purpose of this talk, you have a killing field. And that killing field's got to be time-like. So that's all we want. So this is this equation. So index-free indices don't matter. So what we ask, if I impose these two equations, what can I learn? Answer, we learn the following. There is an asymptotic boost, an asymptotic supertranslation putting this metric into a standard frame. So what I mean by this is the following. So the standard frame means that after you've applied this boost and the supertranslation, then you can set most of these components, gamma and beta and alpha, to zero, at least up to some asymptotic order. So that defines this frame. That defines. So you want to do, so you want to set as many of these to zero. And then alpha d minus 3, that's just the order, turns out to be d minus 3 is a constant. So the lowest order expansion orders are then equal to Minkowski space. And after you have applied this asymptotic boost and asymptotic translation, this killing field agrees with the usual coordinate shift by u. So the meaning of this is the following. Suppose I give, just to make you think about it, suppose I give you boosted Schwarzschild. Not Schwarzschild, you all know Schwarzschild, but I can apply a boost. So then I claim this is not in a standard frame. So this theorem identifies the boost that you must take to go back to your usual Schwarzschild metric. Okay? So and because it's more general, you can, I could give you a boosted and super translated Schwarzschild metric. So I take the one from a Wald's book or Hawking and Ellis or whatever book you like, and I apply a boost and a super translation, and then this theorem identifies the boost and the super translation you need to apply to go back to this form that you find in Carroll or Wald or Misner, Thorn, Wheeler, or whatever. So this is a theorem, of course, you have to prove it. You have to heavily use Einstein's equations and some math to do this. Okay, so now look at non-stationary metrics. So when you have this gravitational radiation, so then you can still do this expansion, and still some of these things are zero, but only up to some other order. And you get various differential relations between these things. I'm not going to write them down. You can just work them out using Einstein. Now, the lowest expansion orders are always different, always the same as Minkowski. So now I want you to appreciate that now you have a bit a qualitative difference between four and higher dimensions. And this is the basic conclusion here for this part of the talk. So for non-radiating metrics, so stationary metrics, the metric components in this standard frame, they start to deviate from Minkowski space at this asymptotic order. It's r to the minus d over 2 plus 1. D is the space-time dimension. And for stationary metrics, they start to deviate from Minkowski space at this order. And the point is, these orders are the same only in four dimensions. So what I'm saying is that if you have a radiating metric, and if you write it down the tail at 1 over r expansion, the non-zero terms come in much come before the non-zero terms in higher dimensions for stationary metrics. Yeah? So it's like saying, you say Schwarzschild is Minkowski plus 1 on R corrections. And a radiating metric is Minkowski plus 1 on R correction in four dimensions. But in 10 dimensions, Schwarzschild is is 1 on r to the 7 deviation, but a radiating metric is 1 on r to the 5. Yeah, so 1 on r to the 4, actually. Yeah, so it's much earlier. So you see, it's the same only in four dimensions. So that's the key difference. That's why higher dimensions are really different. So now the quantities that characterize gravitational radiation are these expansion coefficients were the first ones that deviate from Minkowski string. So it's, for instance, the U derivative of this thing is what is called the Bondi news. I call it Bondi news. And the quantities characterizing the Bondi energy, for instance, is this alpha coefficient at order d minus 3. So you see, this is not the first non-trivial alpha coefficient. So if you want to prove something like the positive Bondi mass theorem, it's much more difficult in higher dimensions because you get the first alpha coefficient. But you can't read off the Bondi mass from that. You have to go further and further into the tail. And then somehow this thing that's 100 orders, but even below the leading one, that's got to be give you positive contribution. It's much more difficult to show.
So you point out this distinction between d equals 4 and higher.
Yeah.
In some sense, it means that in higher than d equals 4, the solutions are much less unique.
That's related, but it's sort of the that.
Can be headed directly from this.
No, I don't think. I think
it looks like a lot more arbitrary functions appear in the high-dimensional case.
Maybe I just. I think it's related, but I think it's the difference is between the time-dependent components sort of coming much earlier, whereas the time-dependent components coming at the same order in 40. Perhaps it's a.
Just one.
But maybe. I have to think. Maybe. Maybe. Okay. Now, let me return now to the situation I want to study. I have a stationary metric here in this room, let's say. Some burst of gravitational radiation comes through stationary again. I ask, what can I learn about the relationship between the metric before the burst came through and after? So I've told you now how to characterize stationary metrics. I've told you how time-dependent metrics are out there, asymptotic behavior. If you ask the relationship between before and after, so I told you that if you have a stationary metric, there's always you can put it into a standard frame. So it's just a way of talking. So you can apply a boost and a super translation so that it looks like your Schwarzschild or Kerr metric from Wald's book. But which boost and which super translation you have to apply may differ before and after. That's the point. And so let me show you this picture. So here is my initial surface. Gravitational radiation comes through. Let's say this is my standard frame. So in this frame, the metric looks like Kerr from your book. Okay. Now, gravitational radiation comes through. It's still stationary, so it's still a Kerr metric, but it's a Kerr metric with a boost and super translation applied to it. So that corresponds, since I told you that a super translation corresponds to this different surface, it means that your standard frame has changed. Yeah? And it's this change in standard frame that is sort of the physically real. That's in four dimensions. In higher dimensions, it turns out the change in reference frame only corresponds to boost. There is no super translation. So a boost it also changes the surface, but it just tilts it, so to speak. Yeah? So that's the basic. So if you want to go away from this talk and remember something, that's the picture. It's got a lot of stuff in it, but it's sort of the, if that's your standard reference frame, then after in four dimensions is this kind of strange wiggly frame that depends on this complicated super translation. And in four dimensions, it's just a boost. Yeah? So in five or six dimensions, it's just a boost applied to a Myers Perry black hole. Whereas in four dimensions is this complicated super translation and boost applied. And which super translation and which boost, of course, depends on what gravitational radiation is. Okay, so now I want to relate this to the memory effect. The memory effect, in essence, is that you have this change. But it's a memory effect, of course, wasn't found this way. And what it is it's the permanent displacement of an arrangement of freely floating test masses which initially are at rest that is produced by a burst of gravitational radiation. So you have your detector array, some gravitational radiation goes through, they oscillate, and then they freeze again. But they don't freeze in the circular arrangement. They freeze in some other arrangement. And that's called the, it remembers, so to speak, that something went through. So that's why it's called memory. And so it's common to express it in terms of a tensor. You say that if you look at the infinitesimal displacement of your test masses, and you look at that, compare that before and after, or the difference, then that's given by a linear transformation per point, so to speak. So it's in how infinitesimally, if it was a circular arrangement, then infinitesimally it's kind of squash it and elongate it. And so that corresponds to a linear transformation. So the squashing and elongating are basically the eigenvalues of this matrix. So it's one matrix per point, so to speak. Yeah, so this is called the memory tensor. And so it was discovered first in a sort of various approximations, and then later these people, and then later 91, Christo Dulo showed that there was some other contribution. So I don't want to go into this detail, this history, but this is what it is. So here is a picture. Again, you have your, in your stationary period, these are your freely floating test masses, and then now some gravitational radiation goes through by Pirani. This corresponds to some deviation, relative acceleration of these things. So they may look like this. And in the end, they look stationary again, but now their distance will have changed. And so this is sort of the, if you think, this is sort of the displacement vector by how much this has changed. Okay, now the way to compute this displacement is, as I alluded to, by the geodesic deviation equation, which you probably all know since the Iranian 1950s. And so this is how you compute it. And then you show, using now your Einstein equation, that in more than four dimensions, this delta is just zero. So there isn't any memory. In fact, it goes back to your circular arrangement. But in four dimensions, this memory tensor is exactly related to the supertranslation. So the supertranslation was this function t here that relates the reference frame. So how the reference frame has been deformed. And so this t is a sort of potential for this memory tensor. Yeah? So you have to remember from this talk, this picture, and that this t here is the potential for the memory tensor. So if you apply two derivatives, you calculate the Hessian of this t, so to speak, you get the memory tensor. Use Einstein equations to show this. So this, discovered by Strominger and these people, our contribution was that we additionally, we made it more general, but additionally we related it to gravitational fluxes. So you can compute this this function which changes supertranslation in the following way. So you take the body energy and body four momentum, or body three momentum, and you calculate this quantity, and you compute the difference before and after. And then you add you have a flux of gravitational radiation per angle, which is just this Newes tensor squared at this angle, and then integrated over u over all time. So how much flux comes in at u at this angle, from this angle in this kind of thing. So this is f of z, so it's an angle-dependent quantity. And if you decompose it into multiples and you add them up in this way, you get you get this t. So you see from this formula that this supertranslation is, pointer died. The supertranslation is physical. It's not just some gauge stuff, because it's really you have a contribution from the change in body energy and momentum, and you have a contribution from the fluxes. So you heavily use Einstein's equation to show this. Now I have to use this pointer here. Now,
it's a hockey stick, isn't it? Hockey stick.
Oh, this famous hockey stick. Yeah, I'd like to use that.
Smart.
Yes. Okay, so let me draw my conclusions from this part of the talk. So in four dimensions, if we have initially and finally stationary metric, then the standard frame is related by an asymptotic boost and an asymptotic supertranslation. And this asymptotic supertranslation, I'm going to have called T all the time, is the potential for the for the memory tensor. So therefore, since you have flux, it's impossible, this manifestly shows it's impossible to bring the metric into the same frame before and after, because you have flux. By contrast, in four dimensions, the initial and final metrics are only related by a boost, and therefore the memory tensor is zero, and it is possible to bring the memory, the metrics into the same standard reference frame. And so by doing this, you effectively reduce the asymptotic symmetry group from the BMS to the Poincaré group. So there's no reason why you should not do this reduction, because you can really choose this preferred reference frame up to boost, when up to boost corresponds to corresponds to Poincaré. So you conclude in four dimensions there is a super translation, and higher dimensions there is. That's it. So now, since people have looked into this in the context of the information loss paradox, I want to ask the technical part is basically over now. I want to ask now this, the question of whether these BMS super translation charges, so this is an asymptotic symmetry, so there is, by Noether's theorem, basically a corresponding charge. So you can ask whether the values of these charges can store information. And so it's clear from the formula I've shown it that this function Tz contains a lot of information about the radiation that's emitted, because it's the sum of all these quadrupole, of all these multipole attributions. But the basic point is you cannot infer it locally from the space-time geometry. You've got to know the metric. It relates the metrics before and after. So just as it's impossible to say, well, this hockey stick is moving, is a totally relative statement. If I go walk with it, it's not moving, it's a trivial fact. But what is the meaningful statement is if it was scattered off another hockey stick or a hockey player, then it wasn't moving before, and so I can change the talk about the difference in momentum. So similarly here, I talk about the difference between these frames. So I have to know the metric before and after the radiation came in. So it's a very global information. And certainly, if you only have access to a space-time, part of the space-time in the future, you cannot know what this T of Z is, because it compares. Yeah? So in that sense, it stores information, but to know it, you have to know the entire space-time anyway. So the whole point about the information loss paradox, if you know all the entire space-time and all the quanta coming out anyway, but there's no paradox in the first place. So the statement should be true in the quantum case. So now let me make a few remarks about the quantum case, because also sometimes people talk about quantum, classical, and so on. So let me just say that. So because I'm not an expert on quantum gravity, I'd like to talk about QED or theories like QED, or very generically, quantum field theory containing abelian gauge fields. And so as you all know, you can write a local gauge transformation as this is the covariant derivative operator, which changes like this under a local gauge transformation. So local means that this function is non-zero only inside a compact set. Yeah, so inside this. So then there are also global gauge transformation, where you have a gauge transformation that may be non-zero even at scry. So this I call global gauge transformation. It's not the same as rigid gauge transformation. So this, you can then talk to about the restriction of this to scry, and you get this function here. And I claim this is now just a phase that's an angle-dependent phase. And I claim this is the exact analog of the BMS transformation, BMS super translation. There it was an angle-dependent translation, and here it's an angle-dependent gauge transformation. So it's a group, it's an abelian group, it's infinite dimensional, and now the point is that the Hilbert space the Hilbert space splits into a direct sum of Hilbert spaces which correspond to irreducible representations of this space. So that's the point. So the vacuum sector corresponds to the trivial representation of the BNS group. So what's the vacuum sector? It's you take the vacuum. So the theory, sometimes people talk as if there were many vacuums. That's just rubbish. The quantum field theory has one unique vacuum, and that's called this. So if you act with local gauge invariant operators, like F mu nu averaged over here or something like that, then I apply everything I can that's local and gauge invariant, then I get this Hilbert space H naught. So that's, but that's just one sector here. You also have all these other sectors. And the other sectors are basically obtained by as the following. You take, now this is a pretty small, but the idea is you take them, you take a Wilson line that starts somewhere, but it goes out all the way to scry. So this is this kind of Wilson line. So this is a fermion, like a Dirac fermion, and this is my Wilson line. And you apply that to the vacuum, or you can take n of those. And then the edge pies are kind of the Hilbert spaces that you obtain by taking these guys and then applying all local operators. So this is, the point is, this is not a local operator because it goes out all the way to scry. And so this carries a non-trivial representation of the BMS group. And these representations are unitarily equivalent to each other, but they're not unitarily equivalent to the vacuum representation. But they change. So the BMS representation, this that acts on this space, it acts trivially on the local observables. And that's why I cannot detect it locally. And so local observers practically cannot distinguish the sector. So for a local observer, he cannot find out what sector. So this Buchholz and Roberts have kind of given a rigorous version of this. So I have another 15 minutes. So I don't want to overstretch your attention. So I'd had something about the information loss.
Is there anything you could do to distinguish them? You said local observers.
You can't.
Can you imagine any?
No, if you have someone who has got access again to the whole space-time, including infinity, he or she can. But you need again to know everything. Just like in the gravitational case, you can't locally know what this super translation was. Here you can't know what gauge frame you're kind of in. You have to. So it's the quantum analog. And so, again, I'm just iterating the same point I already made before. This is back called information loss paradox. You know this picture probably. Evaporating black hole and the puzzle. You get these Hawking quanta come out, and how do they know that that you threw in a teddy bear with one ear only, and you all just get all this low energy quanta coming out?
What's the situation up about when you compare gravitational waves with the electromagnetic waves, which has been a favorite thing to do over the years?
I think it's very analogous, I think. I think I did discuss this quantum version in the electromagnetic case, as I said, because I don't know quantum gravity has also so many other issues. It's very analogous. Yeah, you even have it for scalar fields, actually. Even scalar field, you have an analog of super translations. Same thing.
Okay. It has to be massless.
Massless scalar field. So mass for massless field. So it might be massless. Photons are massless. Massless scalar fields. Massless p-form fields. Everything got the same thing. Okay. So now,
can I just ask for photons and gauge fields also only 40?
Yeah, only 40.
Okay. Between gravity and electromagnetism is that the pseudo tensor in Einstein gravity can be transformed to zero locally. You can't transform the energy of electromagnetism to zero.
Okay, maybe you can, but I mean, these are defined invariantly. I mean, I've talked as if I had coordinates, but. Yeah. So So these are all invariant statements. I've presented them in coordinates, but the coordinates themselves were defined geometrically, so it's invariant. Well, that's the whole point. So that's the whole point I was making. You can, if you have a stationary metric, in a sense, there is a preferred frame. Well, the problem is that there's not just one, but so many. And usually you think of them as related by Lorentz boosts in translations. But in gravity, they also can be related by super translations. So that's the point. Yeah? But just as the particle which moves, I can boost them so that it looks at rest if I move with it. But after it's scattered, there is a relative boost, so to speak. And it's this relative change that I'm talking about, not in the context of boosts, but in terms of super translations.
In general, you're not supposed to choose a preferred frame.
I have a stationary metric satisfying the Einstein equations. And this is a completely invariant statement. And it has a time-like Killing field. And so in that case, I can prove there is a completely invariant procedure to define these frames. And it relies on Einstein's equations and on technicalities that I wasn't able, and I wouldn't care. Or maybe it's not, they're not suitable for this kind of problem. Okay. So I'm a bit thrown off now. So the puzzle, the proposal was somehow to say that you would measure all these super translation charges later, and to say that somehow by measuring them, they would kind of store the information that came in. And what I'm saying is that you can't know just by local observation the change in EMS frame. So you got to know the entire space time. But if you know the entire space time, you anyway know that you threw this teddy in. And you don't have to use a super translation charge. You just look at what you throw in. Okay, so there is a simple version of this where instead of this complicated gravitational field obeying the Einstein equation, you just talk about particles. And it's a sort of an approximation because you treat the particles just in the test particle approximation. So and you treat them in Minkowski space. So the way it works, if you test particles just geodesics, they just move on straight lines and they collide. So because this conformal diagram, the lines look curvy, but they're really straight. And they meet and then they are reflected, they bounce off each other, you have momentum for momentum conservation at the apex. And now you can easily show that in linearized approximation to gravity, there is no gravitational radiation coming as long as the particles move inertially. And none afterwards, but where they meet, you have a burst of radiation coming out, and you can compute then what is the memory tensor and all this just based on what your knowledge about the particle trajectories. And the answer it was found in a paper by myself and Tolish and Wald and Ishibashi. And so these are just the details of the calculation. So you know that from Weinberg book or something that if you have a particle, you can associate with it a distributional stress tensor that's non-zero only on the particle world line. That's how it looks like. There's some gamma factors, blah, blah, blah. And then you have a contribution from each particle. And that's the source in your Einstein equation. And as I said, you have, again, in higher dimensions, this tensor is displaced, memory tensor is zero. In four dimensions, again, it's even in this approximation being given by this super translation. And you can actually compute the super translation in terms of the particle momenta. And it's this kind of same formula where E and P are the four momenta of the particle. I is the index, the ith particle. You have in and outgoing particles. And it's something log something. It looks like a von Neumann entropy.
You're doing this in Minkowski.
Yeah, this just tests particles in Minkowski just for illustrative purposes. And so there is no term from the gravitational flux because this would be a higher order effect. So it's absent. So you just have this first term, which has got this pi log pi. Some sense, it can be associated with the von Neumann entropy. Okay, now let me conclude. little bit before time, so the memory effect is special to four dimensions. It's closely related to the idea that BMS frames change. The information is stored in this change of frames. It's a function of angles, super translation, and it's related to the collection of all multiple moments of gravitational flux and the relation between the bonding form of energy, for example. So it's information, but it's a very global information. And in QED-like theories, the Hilbert space is composed of the sectors that correspond to unitary irreducible representation of BMS. So here with BMS, I mean this analog of BMS, which is gauge transformation. And I think I want to conclude.
Things that you pointed out in the context of QED is that the appropriate BMS-like group is abelian,
mm-hmm.
and that leads to this lots of irreducible representations.
Mm-hmm.
But they are presumably organized according to this abelian nature of the BMS group.
Yeah. So if it just was U1, your presentation of U1, or just wrapping number, yeah, so I want to see, but I don't, BMS group is kind of also classify, it's just a bit more, but it's not related to abelian, but I think.
My question was going to be in the relativist, in general relativity, the group is non-abelian.
Yeah.
And I think it would make an enormous difference, the comparison.
Yeah,
there will be some similarities between QED and quantum. Quantum gravity, but the fact that it is non-abelian is also very significant.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know what's the Hilbert space for quantum gravity. People here study these complicated issues, of course, all the time. But you're right. It's maybe some. So to be the honest answer is I haven't really thought about gravity in the quantum context. Of course, you could talk about linearized gravity. So that would be tractable by usual QFT techniques. But with a full gravity, I have no idea. So good.
Any cosmology, we do not have asymptotic flash.
Yeah, indeed.
Land is positive.
Uh-huh.
What do you do about that?
Nothing. so it's the same question as what you do about black holes, because you can't define them. You know, if you look in Hawking and Ellis, the black hole is defined as the complement of the past of future null infinity. If you don't have future null infinity, what's the black hole? But we don't seem to. It's an idealization. Yeah. So you see what I'm saying?
Do you think the BMS charges would exist if
land was different? No, I think it's really different. I think maybe Ashtekar has worked on
it. It is very different.
Yeah.
There are no BMS super translations.
And it's also different in ADS. So in ADS, really, the group is just the ADS group, no super. They have super stuff, but that's super symmetry. That's different. Yes, well, okay, but I'm just making the point that ADS is different also, as you're making the point that Disidor is different. So it's just you have an isolated system, you want to describe an isolated system, and you need some, what does it mean isolated? You mean you have some system and lots of empty stuff around. And so this empty stuff is, in this case, Minkowski space or approximately. So if you don't have an isolated system, you just have a mess. There's no any such notion.
More questions?
I was curious about your statements about d equals 4 and d greater than 4.
Yeah.
So you were very discouraging in terms of measuring memory effects, but say we were to measure a memory effect, discouraging in the sense that you need global information.
Yeah.
No, but where to measure a memory?
No. I'm not. What I mean by global is I need the metric before and after the radiation, which in practice is just now some signal and data. So it's a matter of seconds before and after.
Good, but it's
still global in this sense. I don't have to go back to the beginnings of time and the end of time. You know. But I mean in the information loss paradox, that would be going back to eons and the beginning of time or something.
But the question is, say we were to measure a memory effect, then are you really saying strongly that that would mean we are in four space-time dimensions?
You mean whether we have some hidden extra dimensions or I see what you're saying. You would have to be looking for asymptotically Kaluza-Klein spacetimes, really, and I think you'd have a memory effect in asymptotically Kaluza-Klein spacetimes if the large dimensions is 4 and the small dimensions is any.
That's what I want.
So I don't think it will rule out extra dimensions. If that's your question. I don't. Yeah, good question.
Sorry, very naive. So to the standard wisdom that S-matrix elements are all would be the only way to actually even define operation in quantum gravity, etc. So let's not talk about quantum gravity in particular, but so does your picture add something? So does it make it more subtle to define S-matrix elements?
No, this is not about S-matrix. No, S-matrix, I have to emphasize difference. The S-matrix...
experiments from scry minus to scry plus and...
But the memory, I think that's another confusion. The memory effect is not about... So the memory effect is not about scry minus and scry plus, but it's about this situation, so you can forget about scry minus. Yeah, so it's about... it's about this. You set up some source inside some finite time, and the burst comes out. If you're here, you're the observable. You see the burst coming through, and you see it stop. And you don't need. It's not about a relationship between scry plus and scry minus. It's different. It's nothing to do with it. I think maybe in some papers that this was kind of connected with it. It's not. I'm saying that it's meaningless to try to connect scry plus and scry minus, that will be your S matrix. But it doesn't have much to do with what I was talking about.
It does disagree with what other people.
Perhaps, yes.
I mean, many people are working upon the memory effect as an infrared property of the S matrix. So, presumably, they don't quite agree on this point.
What I'm saying is to discuss the kind of issue that. I was talking about, you don't need scry minus, you can forget about it. That is not to say that if you have, you're going to have stuff coming, going down that way as well. So, and in sort of in my particle, the colliding particles, that's like a toy version of S matrix, just that I have mechanical particles. And you still have a BMS transformation T, I even gave you the formula for it. So I'm sure, I mean, people I'm working on this, the field theoretic S matrix will have a relationship too. But what I'm saying is this basic discussion, how is it, it doesn't necessarily depend on the idea of the S matrix. You see what I'm saying? Any other question?
Okay. Good, thank you.